Those of you who have been around here for a while know that for the last several years, I've chosen as my topic in my first sermon of the year to highlight a person or persons who, because of their deep faith, have done something that has changed the world for the better. This year, I've chosen the life and accomplishments of a man named Clarence Jordan to examine with you. He's probably best known as the translator of the Cotton Patch version of several of the books of the New Testament, an impressive enough accomplishment in itself. But he was much more, a man of courage and conviction who inspired by example and changed the world. It's always good to start at the beginning, which for Clarence Jordan was July 29, 1912, in Talbotton, Georgia, a small town in the west central part of the state. He was the middle child of seven in a large, comfortable family. Even though his father, Edgar, owned the local bank and adjoining general store, Edgar expected his children to work and not be spoiled by their privileged position in the community. Still, Clarence had plenty of time for an idyllic rural childhood, playing in the creeks and fields and exploring the woods and other delights. One of the highlights for the Jordan brothers was a treehouse they built in the tallest tree on the highest hill right outside of town. They called it Hog Hotel, since their mother, in her exasperation at the mess seven children were forever creating, would demand that they pick up after themselves because, "I'm not running a hog hotel here." The family were regular attenders of the local Baptist church, where Clarence declared his faith and was baptized at the age of 12. He, as a serious, reflective child, was troubled by the world he saw around him, especially as he tried to square it with the spiritual teaching he was receiving at home and church. He was especially moved by all the poverty he saw in Talbot County, with its squalor and hunger and hopelessness. He also was increasingly distressed by the racial injustice that was woven so deeply into the fabric of Southern culture at the time. Children sang about Jesus loving all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, yet it sure looked to young Clarence as if Jesus played favorites with the white children. But nothing he was learning about Jesus made that likely. In fact, just the opposite was true. The racism and segregation that was a Southern everyday way of life deeply unsettled him. The county jail was across the street from his family home, making it easy for Clarence to wander over to visit with the black prisoners coming and going on the chain gangs the county sponsored. He was saddened by their tales of woe. He also had the opportunity to watch the local sheriff, a supposedly kindly Christian churchgoer, turn into a cruel tyrant who brutalized the prisoners in his care. All the perceived injustices around him made him question his faith and dig deep for answers. One thing he knew for sure was he felt called to do what he could to help the poor. When it came time to go to college, everyone assumed he would go to law school. He talked a lot, questioned everything, and liked to argue, so it seemed the natural choice. Clarence, however, had other ideas. When he announced that he wanted to major in agriculture, his disappointed father suggested that he could buy him some acreage and a mule, and he could get started right away. Clarence said no, that he wanted to learn all the latest and best ways to farm so that he could grow as much food as possible to help the poor. His father, to his credit, humored him by supporting 4 years at the University of Georgia, where Clarence did indeed major in agriculture. In college, Clarence found that the required ROTC was something he enjoyed so much that he stayed in for all 4 years of college instead of stopping after the required two, choosing to be in a cavalry unit over the infantry. In fact, after graduation, he decided to begin officer's training with the intention of making the Army his career. It was during this training that he had an epiphany that changed the direction of his life. One morning, as part of their exercises, the young trainees were to gallop through the woods on their horses, stabbing straw dummies with their bayonets and shooting person-shaped targets with their guns. As Clarence was shooting and stabbing, the verses he'd been reading and memorizing about loving your enemies and turning the other cheek kept running through his mind, and he realized that he was going one way and Jesus was going the other, that this was terribly wrong, and he couldn't do it. He quit the cavalry on the spot. Already a person of strong convictions, at that moment he became a lifelong pacifist. I probably should point out that I don't necessarily agree with Clarence's decision here. This isn't a sermon about just war theories or pacifism as a moral choice. I'm pretty sure that's above my pay scale. But I do know Clarence had sound, studied reasons for his decision, and I respect him for making it. So here he was, 21 years old, and not sure what to do with his life. It was 1933, his father's bank had failed in 1929, and there weren't many options for young men in the middle of the Depression. Then, at a Baptist retreat in North Carolina, he had an experience that decided things for him. He heard a voice he believed to be God telling him, "My child, I want you to preach for me." By fall, Clarence had been ordained by his college church in Athens, Georgia, and was enrolled in Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He supported himself mostly by supply preaching. 3 years later, he graduated with a keen interest in and appreciation for the Greek and Hebrew languages. It especially fascinated and inspired him to be able to read scriptures in their original languages. He also now had a wife. Florence Kroger had been a library assistant in the seminary library when they met. They shared a deep concern for the plight of the poor and a passion to help. She had both a strong faith and a spirit of adventure, qualities she would need in the years ahead, married to Clarence. One of their first decisions made together was for Clarence to continue at Southern Baptist Seminary in their doctrinal program. He continued his supply preaching, but also took on teaching English New Testament at Simmons University, a Negro seminary in Louisville. His work among the poor and Black communities in Louisville led him to take on the directorship of a small mission in a Black neighborhood. He took on more and more responsibility as he tried more and more ways to alleviate the hardcore poverty around him and worked towards acceptance between the races. He was hardworking, charming, young and fun, and made good progress in spite of frequent setbacks and frustrations. He stayed on for another year after he received his degree. He and Florence had a daughter now, the first of their four children. But a dream was forming in his heart. His studies of the New Testament had not only strengthened his resolve to help the poor, but convinced him of the importance of community in living the Christian life. He was intrigued by the first century Jerusalem church, who band together, living communally, and sharing what they had. He became convinced that if modern Christians would return to that way of living, problems of race discrimination and class distinction and other divisions would dissolve into a communion of fellowship and union, all fueled by love. If the rest of the world could witness a group of believers truly living a Christ-like life, they would want that kind of peace and belonging too, and be drawn into the faith, perhaps inspired to form their own communities of Christian love. The more Clarence thought about it, the more he wanted to try it. He was further inspired when he met a couple who had been having very much the same dream as he in Florence. Martin and Mabel England were missionaries to Burma, who had been forced to return to the United States because of the onset of World War. Martin was even studying agriculture in preparation for such a venture. To make a long story short, the two couples made their dream a reality. They promoted their vision, raised funds, and bought a farm near Americus, Georgia, in the southwest part of the state, and in 1942 moved in. They named it Koinonia, the Greek word translated fellowship, sharing in common. Soon others started coming too, and they had a community. At first, everything went smoothly. Clarence and Martin used the latest farming techniques, producing great crops, which provided enough to feed themselves, help their poor neighbors, and have some left over to sell. The roadside stand they built to sell their extra produce expanded to include refrigerator units to sell the meat that they were also producing. They were able to supply eggs to all the stores in the area from their state-of-the-art chicken operation. Fruit and pecan orchards were planted. Concerned about the poor sharecropper neighbors' inability to provide milk for their children, they came up with the idea of a milk cow lending library. People could borrow a milk cow for free, and when she went dry, bring her back to trade for another. They were active in the community also. They observed that even though a school bus was provided for the white children, the black children had to get themselves to their school. This meant long walks for many of them, if they made it at all. The Koinonia members set up teams to drive the black children to school so they could have an opportunity for education too. The families all attended the Rehoboth Baptist Church down the road from the farm, where they participated fully in everything available, preaching, teaching, singing in the choir, all the worship services. They were always happy to help in any way they could. There were murmurings among the community about the Koinonia way of life and their friendliness to black families, but everything went along fairly smoothly until they hired a black farmhand, whom they invited to share lunch with them at their communal table. This was a step too far for their white neighbors in the late 40s South, and they started making their displeasure known. A group of men showed up looking for Clarence Jordan. When he stepped up to them, their spokesman said, "We understand you've been taking your meals with a N-word." Clarence answered quietly, "Well, at lunchtime, we usually eat with the man we've hired." The man angrily replied, "We're from the Ku Klux Klan, and we're here to tell you we don't allow the sun to set on anyone who eats with N-words." Clarence thought hard how to reply, and then suddenly smiled a big smile, grabbed the man by the hand, and started pumping it up and down. "I'm a Baptist preacher, and I just graduated from a Baptist seminary. I read in the Bible that Joshua made the sun to stand still in the sky, but I never thought I'd meet someone like him in South Georgia. I'm glad to meet you." The men stared at him for a second and then started laughing and talking. The situation was diffused for the time being, but the Ku Klux Klan is not noted for their sense of humor, and there was more to come. Clarence, as an entertaining and moving speaker, was being asked to teach or preach more and more all over the country. Increasingly, he was working the subject of racial justice and equality into his talks. This wasn't going over well back home in southern Georgia, including in his own home church. Things came to a head in 1950 when a man from Burma arrived to visit the farm. The Englands had gone back to Burma by then, and since they were being partially supported by the Rehoboth Baptist Church, the Koinonia group thought the church would be eager to meet someone from Burma. They were wrong. Evidently, the Baptists were not aware that Burmese people have dark skin. The end result was that Clarence Jordan and everyone from Koinonia Farm was voted out of the Rehoboth Baptist Church and barred from attending again. It was a harsh blow. They, of course, immediately set up their own worship service to augment the Bible studies they already had in progress. But to be barred from worshiping with Christian brothers and sisters they had thought were their friends was a stinging slap in the face. But this was only the beginning. As Black folk continued to join the Koinonia community, or work for them, or be helped by them, and be treated with the same love and respect as white people, the anger and resentment in the surrounding area continued to grow and fester. Then all this hatred turned violent. Their roadside stand was shot up, their refrigerator units ruined. Then the whole rebuilt stand was burned. Their crops were damaged, fruit and nut trees cut down. Night marauders put sugar into the gas tanks, ruining tractors and other vehicles. Fences were cut, letting out their animals. Clarence said at one point that their pigs were out on the highway so much at night that they were considering pinning reflector lights on their tails. But even worse, they were shot at. Shots were fired into their house at night. Drive-by shooters would shoot into the midst of people working outside. They would even shoot into groups of children at play. The children had to learn to lie down on the floor if they were in the house and heard shots, and to run for the trees if a car slowed down while they were working or playing outside. The children were bullied and tormented at school, too, to the point that some of the older ones feared for their lives and were sent off to finish school with friends or relatives. In spite of many close calls, no one was ever shot, but not for lack of trying on the part of their enemies. One man was beaten as he tried to deliver packages to the post office. The authorities suggested he had done it to himself in an attempt to garner sympathy. Not only were they subjected to physical violence, but the community tried economic harassment. Their roadside stand was kept out of commission. Their egg buyers stopped doing business with them. No one in the surrounding towns would sell them groceries or seed or fertilizer or gasoline or anything they needed to run their farm. Their insurance policies were canceled. Anyone who tried to do business with them found a cross burning in their front yard, or worse. One merchant's store was firebombed overnight. The Klan, in fact, held a rally where the main attraction was to form a parade of 70 cars that drove slowly and silently through their property and back out again. They could expect no help from the authorities, as the assaulted man could tell you. Just the opposite, in fact. One time a group from another community in the north was bringing the farm something that involved pulling a trailer. As they approached the farm, they got mixed up on directions, so stopped at a gas station to call. The station owner recognized that they were heading to Koinonia Farm and became belligerent. He told them they could not continue through his station, which meant that they would have to back out. In attempting to do so, an earthen bridge started to collapse under their wheel. About then, the sheriff showed up and they thought, oh good, he'll help us. But no. He told them that he could not allow them to back up onto the highway. A crowd gathered, some with guns. Word made it to Koinonia people, so some of the men came with a tractor to pull them out. But the sheriff wouldn't allow them to use it. They had to go back to get jacks and were finally able to get the vehicles up and turned around so that they could drive out onto the highway and get away. This cruel harassment went on, not for a few months, but for many years. Some Koinonia people gave up, worn out by the tension and fear, but the core group remained, determined to live Christ-like lives and show only love to their enemies. To survive financially, they started a mail-order pecan business that thrived and grew to include fruitcakes and candies, and is still in business today. Their slogan was, "Help us ship the nuts out of Georgia." Florence Jordan was once asked if she had ever been afraid. She answered that yes, she had often been afraid, but that she knew that if any of them were killed, they would not be the first Christians to die for their faith, and they would not be the last. During this time period, Clarence couldn't do much farming, so turned to a project that had long been on his mind. As a frequent guest speaker preaching or teaching or promoting Koinonia Farm around the country, he used his Greek Bible and translated as he read. Frequently, to make it all more accessible to his audiences, he translated in a sort of colloquial paraphrase, as if the Bible events were happening currently in the South, as he knew it. Jerusalem became Atlanta, Bethlehem became Valdosta, a small town in southern Georgia. People's names also were modernized. Peter means rock in Greek, and Bar-Jonah means son of John, so Peter and Andrew became Rock and Andy Johnson. He called it his cotton patch version, and his audiences loved it. People started urging him to write it down and publish it. Now he had time, so he built a little shack in a quiet spot on the farm and started writing. He felt a special connection to Paul, so started with his epistles, and later went on to translate Luke and Acts. It turned out his audiences had been right. His works were published to critical acclaim and are still being enjoyed today. By setting the New Testament in the mid-20th century American South, Clarence Jordan infused it with a haunting immediacy that still moves us today. I'll read my text for this sermon, Luke 10:25-37, from the Cotton Patch to give you an example of his work. The Parable of the Good Samaritan. One day, a teacher of an adult Bible class got up and tested him with this question, "Doctor, what does one do to be saved?" Jesus replied, "What does the Bible say? How do you interpret it?" The teacher answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your physical strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "That is correct," answered Jesus. "Make a habit of this and you'll be saved." But the Sunday school teacher, trying to save face, asked, "But just who is my neighbor?" Then Jesus laid into him and said, "A man was going from Atlanta to Albany, and some gangsters held him up. When they had robbed him of his wallet and brand new suit, they beat him up and drove off in his car, leaving him unconscious on the shoulder of the highway. Now it just so happened that a white preacher was going down the same highway. When he saw the fellow, he stepped on the gas and went scooting by. Shortly afterwards, a white gospel song leader came down the road, and when he saw what had happened, he too stepped on the gas. Then a black man traveling that way came upon the fellow, and what he saw moved him to tears. He stopped and bound up his wounds as best he could, drew some water from his water jug to wipe away the blood, and then laid him on the back seat. He drove on into Albany and took him to the hospital and said to the nurse, 'You all take good care of this white man I found on the highway. Here's the only $2 I got, but you all keep account of what he owes, and if he can't pay it, I'll settle up with you when I make a payday.' Now, if you had been the man held up by the gangsters, which of these three, the white preacher, the white song leader, or the black man, would you consider to have been your neighbor?" The teacher of the adult Bible class said, "The one who treated me kindly." Jesus said, "Well then, you get going and start living like that." It is such a loss that he died before he was able to finish what he had started. What we do have is an amazing accomplishment that it continues to resonate and inspire well into the 21st century. In December 1965, vacationing, Carol and Millard Fuller and family stopped at Koinonia Farm to have lunch with friends living there and ended up staying a month. Later, they returned to join the community. Clarence and Millard were always looking for new ways to help the poor. They decided that as affordable housing was a constant problem for the poor, the farmland not under cultivation because of the boycott would be a good place to build some houses. They came up with the idea of raising funds for the first house, and then the interest-free payments the new owners would be making could be used to start another home. The project would grow bigger and bigger. Not being ones to sit around when they had an idea, they got right on it, and it worked. Houses started popping up on the property. They called it partnership housing, and their appeal for money, the Fund for Humanity. In 1975, Millard and Carol Fuller took this concept one step farther and established Habitat for Humanity, an international organization that has now built 600,000 houses, providing shelter for over 29 million people all over the world. And it all started with one house built on the back 40 of Koinonia Farm. Sadly, Clarence wasn't there to be a part of it. On October 29, 1969, everything was going pretty well on Koinonia Farm. The terrible violence they'd endured for years had mostly slacked off. There were several families living together in harmony. Clarence's cotton patch translations were popular and widely appreciated, as were his speaking engagements, and the housing project was taking off. Clarence hadn't been feeling well for a few days, but thought he felt better enough to do some writing, so went to his writing shack to work on his next translation, the Book of Jack. While visiting with a farm member who had stopped in for some advice, Clarence collapsed and was gone. He was only 57 years old. It was somehow fitting that when the family called to have someone come out to confirm his death and sign the death certificate, neither the coroner nor the doctor would set foot on the property. They had to load his body into the station wagon and take him into town. Clarence was buried the next day in a plain pine box, wearing his overalls, on a hilltop overlooking the farm. Millard Fuller read some verses from the cotton patch, First Rock and First Jack, and then unexpectedly, two-year-old Faith Fuller stepped up to the edge of the grave and sang Happy Birthday to Clarence. They knew he would have thought it was perfect. So Clarence Jordan, a determined, courageous man of faith, changed the world. His bold, gritty translation of the New Testament continues to capture the reality of life today. His overwhelming desire to help the poor lives on in every house built by Habitat for Humanity. But perhaps most of all, his rock-solid belief that the communion of Jesus Christ is for all believers to be shared equally, side by side, and always in the most sacred love, lives on in part because of his courageous and steadfast example.
You've been listening to Joanne Trammell at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to those local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep those podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button, or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.